Set on the mute button. There we go. Good aim from me. I'd love you to just humour me for a minute. And I want to invite you to do a little object lesson. I want you to imagine that there's a pair of glasses just seated underneath your seat. And I'm going to be watching particularly the blokes here to see if they join in. I want you to reach down, everybody, reach down underneath your chair. Grab out the glasses case, just open them up in front of you. Pull out your glasses, open them up, and just put them on your face. Because this morning I want to invite you to put on a different set of glasses. That's essentially what we're doing this morning. And I want to ask a question: what are you looking at? Or maybe what do you see? What draws your attention? What consumes your attention? And I'm going to make a super profound statement here. Where you are looking determines what you will see. Now, we're in our last week of Revelation. I want to spend a little bit of time doing a little recap of the book, but it's also significant, I want to say, that this passage, Revelation 21, a little bit of 22 I'm going to look at as well, comes at the end of the story of Scripture. It's this grand narrative that spans from Genesis chapter 1 and 2, where we see a story of creation, to what we're seeing here in Revelation 21 and 22 is a picture of a new creation. And so this passage sits at the end of that span, this vision of a new creation in Revelation 21. And we've already heard that Revelation is a letter that was written to the churches who are living under the rule of the Roman Empire at the time. It's a time when Rome was turning up the pressure on all the people that lived within their empire to pay their tribute to worship Caesar, the emperor. These are people trying to hold on to their faith in the midst of a powerful empire with a powerful dominant story or worldview that is very different to this new story that they've just adopted about Jesus of Nazareth. So it's written to people whose way of life is under pressure. Their view of the world and of what is true is being challenged by the circumstances of their lives. If we go back to Revelation chapter 1 and verse 9, we're told that the author John is writing to a bunch of believers, and he refers to them as being partners with him in tribulation, in the kingdom, and in perseverance. Chapter 1, verse 9. And the word he uses there for tribulation or suffering is this word thlipsis. I love this word, thlipsis. Thlipsis is a word that refers to the process of two things pressing in on each other. So think about what happens when two things press in on each other, right? If you've got two hands and they're pressing in on each other, it produces friction, it produces heat. Or you think about two tectonic plates coming into contact with one another, there's this seismic friction that happens. It's a tension, there's a clash. That tension is thlipsis. So my partner's in thlipsis, is what John says. And I think we're experiencing something like that in our culture at the moment. What's clashing is what some people call worldviews, or what I like to refer to as stories of reality, right? We live our lives by a guiding story. For us, for many of us, I'm sure, sitting here this morning, we seek to live our lives by the Jesus story. What God says to be true of the world governs the way we see the world. And that story is more and more distinct and distant from the dominant stories that we find in our culture around us. It's a thlipsis. And Revelation at its heart gives us perspective on how we can live faithfully as followers of Jesus in the midst of that tension. And the people that John wrote this vision for, you have to understand, had very little influence in their culture. So their situation's a little bit different to ours. They didn't hold any positions of power. They didn't have any significant institutional structures that perpetuated their worldview or their way of thinking into the world. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine what it would be like to live in a place where everyone and everything is shouting at you that what you believe does not make sense? Into that context, John drops this compelling vision that we find in the book of Revelation. I want to go back for a few minutes just to go back to chapter 4 and 5. Andrew unpacked this for us a few weeks ago. And we see there, don't we, that John says, "I looked." Take a moment to adjust your glasses with me. We're going to see something here. "I looked, and there before me was a door open to heaven. And a voice I heard before said to me, 'Come up here. Come up here through the door. I'm going to show you something. Something that must take place.'" The second most common command in the book of Revelation is the command to behold or to look. It's not an invitation, it's a command. Come and look at this. The first most common command is do not be afraid. And I want to suggest that there is a clear link, friends, between where we are looking and whether or not we feel afraid. Do not be afraid. Come and look. I've got something to show you. And I guess I also want to suggest this morning that Revelation is not merely a door into and a vision of the future, although that is in a very true sense true, but it's actually also just a door into a vision of another dimension of reality, another way of seeing reality. John's guides are giving him and giving us, particularly in Revelation 4 and 5, a heavenly perspective on the reality of our lives. So again, back in Revelation chapter 4, John's taken up. He says, "There before me," the first thing that he sees in Revelation 4 is a throne. Someone sitting on it. So where are we through much of Revelation? We're in the throne room. Think with me for a moment about the throne room. What happens in throne rooms? Not so much today, but think about in their time. What happens in throne rooms? Do you confess in church that occasionally you've watched things like Game of Thrones? I don't know if anyone here has watched it, okay? You've got to fast forward through the nasty bits, but if you watch something like Game of Thrones or maybe Vikings, or like, you get a picture of what a throne room actually, what it was actually about back in the day, right? The throne room is where ruling happens. It's not just a beautiful room where someone sits. This is where stuff happens. This is where decisions are made. And this throne room is a very special throne room. The throne room of heaven is what a former teacher of mine, a guy called Daryl Johnson, describes as the control room for the cosmos. This is where decisions are made that have an influence and an impact on the whole of the creation, the whole of the cosmos. This is where cosmic realities come to be. And so through the rest of chapter 4 and then the rest of Revelation quickly, you have this central and consistent image of God seated on the throne. Going back to chapter 5, verse 1, we're told again that John sees, and then in the right hand of the one that is sitting on the throne is this scroll that I know we've looked back at this scroll a number of times. Our gaze, think about this, our gaze, our attention is drawn to this scroll. We're looking at the scroll. Most interpreted as something like the scroll of history, that within it lies the secrets that unlock what the truth of history is all about. This scroll has written on it something of enormous significance. And then an angel booms out, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open this scroll?" And there's silence. It's as if the whole fate of the world hinges on this scroll being unlocked, but nobody comes forward. And we're told that John begins to weep. In fact, it says he wept and he wept. This is a moment of incredible despair. But a voice comes, "Don't weep. The Lion of Judah can open the scroll." And then John, presumably still through wells of tears, reopens his eyes. He looks up and he sees. What does he see? He sees something incredible. something beyond incredible. What does he see? The Lion of Judah roaring with power, opening the scroll? No, he sees a slain lamb. And then verse 7, the slain lamb takes the scroll from the one who is already sitting on the throne, from God, and from verse 8, when the scroll is handed over to the slain lamb, you get this picture through to the end of the chapter of the throne room of heaven literally erupting with praise because the lamb has taken the scroll. I believe what John is seeing here is nothing short of a picture of the turning point in the battle for the cosmos, for all of creation. And because this slain lamb has entered the fray, good will prevail. And friends, then through Revelation 5 through Revelation 19, you have a series that we've unpacked over the last few weeks of visions that describe these opening of the seven seals that Todd went through with us, the judgment of God on the Empire of Babylon that Will unpacked for us. Last week, Enoch helped us start to lift our eyes again to see this beautiful picture of a celebration of a wedding feast when God's people will celebrate with God. And then we have the culmination of this series of visions of things that we see in Revelation chapter 21. Once again, in Revelation 21, the center of the picture is a throne. We find ourselves in a throne room. And once again, we're beckoned by John. Come, see something. Come and see what I am seeing. And here we see this picture that was unpacked so beautifully through the kids' video, a picture of a new heaven and a new earth, a new creation. Through the previous chapters that we haven't unpacked fully, particularly Revelation chapter 20, we've been in this old space, this old place. People gathered around the throne. We've seen the judgment of the old order, both good and bad. We've seen evil and empire vanquished, but now we see the creation made new. It's a transition point at the beginning of Revelation chapter 21 from a picture of calamity and battle and judgment to this new place. And within it is this picture, within this new place is another picture of a holy city, a new Jerusalem. And the key thing that John wants us to see, I think, is that this is a picture of a dwelling place for God's people with God. And the point is that God is with us. God is with us. Verse 3, a loud voice from the throne says, "Look, God's dwelling place is now among the people. He will dwell with them." Literally, God tabernacles with us. God comes to be with us. They will be his people. God himself will be with them and be their God. Later in the chapter, we're told that this new city has no temple. Think back to Old Testament times. The temple, such a central image, a place where God dwells with his people. But all its rituals and its partitions and its barriers, you had to enter through these layers of the temple to get to the Holy of Holies where God dwelt. Friends, there is no special ritual or special place to go to meet with God in this new city. No, this is full access, the dwelling place of God. Is with God's people. In verse 5, God speaks. It doesn't seem that amazing that God speaks. All through these visions, we've had this picture of God on the throne, seated there. Until we realize that throughout all of those visions, with the throne at the center of these visions, this is only one of a couple of times in the whole of the book that is actually God speaking. John hears these voices over and over again telling him things, but it's only a couple of times that it's actually God speaking. We need to pay attention to what is being said here. And God says from the throne, I am making all things new. I am making all things new. Verse 6, God speaks again and he says, it is done. God says, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega. I am the beginning and the end. I brought this creation into being and I am bringing it to its fulfillment. And friends, as we progress then through Revelation 21, the rest of that chapter, and into Revelation 22 that we haven't read, but we have a picture of John going up onto a mountain and seeing this new city. We have a vision of a city of what this dwelling place will be like. And without going into too much detail, the video again did a great job of that. We see that this holy city is a massive city, a city bigger than we can see or imagine. And yet John sees it. We see a glorious city. We see a city made of gold. We see a secure and a safe place. We see a holy city where holiness is embraced. We see a city with no night, no electricity, no candles, because the glory of God lights it up. And as I said, no temple, because God and the Lamb dwell there. And friends, this city is a place of life. The river, the picture of that which brings life, flows, as we've seen. Where does it flow from? From the throne, where God and the Lamb are sitting. The source of this river is the throne. It flows through the middle of the city, and trees spring up and bear fruit and blossom as it flows. It brings life to the city, a constant spring of everlasting life. A picture, I think, of the life-giving Spirit of God being sent into the city. It's a compelling picture. Friends, it's one of being known, of being comforted, of receiving life in abundance from the source of life, of never enduring pain or mourning or grief or tears. All is well. And for me, I think the picture I have is one particularly of a place where you can rest. Where you can rest from the strivings of life in this earth. And you can enjoy the presence of God. See, apocalyptic literature like we see in Revelation is designed to help us put on a new set of glasses. It's helping us lift our eyes to see a new reality. So friends, when we experience the clash and the tension, when our story is not acceptable to the world around us, when our story is not acceptable to the people that we love, when we doubt, when we are tempted to despair, the message of Revelation is an invitation to see reality differently. Yes, we might experience some degree of discomfort, even suffering perhaps. What John refers to as thlipsis, but thlipsis is momentary. It is not eternal. And I think the point I want to make very clearly today is that there is nothing we can do. There is nothing we can do to make this picture in Revelation anything other than reality. Yes, it's a picture, but it's a picture of a different reality. A new creation. And there is nothing we can do to stop it from coming to fruition. I mentioned we work at Seed. We believe at Seed that God invites us to embody the reality of this new creation in our lives. Yes, you are told, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, you are a new creation as an individual. Because of what Jesus has done for you, you are a new creation. You are invited to live out that reality in your own life. What I think we see here is the reality that it's not just about you, but this is about the whole of creation. You as a new creation will dwell with God within a new creation. God, by God's grace through Jesus, has brought all things under Jesus' feet. And this is a picture of what happens when that comes to its fulfillment. A new creation will be. That is the reality. And if we're going to live that reality, I guess, into the places where God has put us, then I think one of the tools that we need in our toolbox is to recapture the role of the imagination in the Christian life. C.S. Lewis was perhaps the greatest proponent of the imagination for the Christian faith. He often referred to as the Christian life as a state of being awake or of wakefulness. He lamented that many of us are at best only half awake. We think we're engaged with reality, with the real world, but in fact, for Lewis, we're living in what he called the Shadowlands, which you'll know well from the title of the movie about him. And Lewis spoke of the imagination as casting brightness into the shadowlands of our world. This dim, daydreaming view of life that the world has lulled us into with its stories. Friends, if we indeed believe in the promises of God, if we believe in a powerful God, if we believe God's designation here that all things are being made new, then there is no deeper or more concrete reality than this newness. The new creation will be. We simply participate in the reality of what God is achieving by his grace. We participate with God in this new creation. But in order to bring that to life, we need to first learn to see it. And once we've seen it, choose to live it into the present where it clashes with the shadowlands. Lewis captures this beautifully, I think, in a book called The Great Divorce. Some of you might have read it. If you haven't, it's this beautiful, I think, a beautiful book. But essentially what happens in The Great Divorce is there are people living in a place called Greytown. And these people in Greytown get onto a bus and the bus takes them somewhere. And where they arrive is essentially, I think, the outskirts of heaven. And then these heavenly beings come down from this beautiful place that they can't quite see and meet the inhabitants of Greytown in this place that's essentially kind of the outskirts of heaven. And there's interactions between the inhabitants of Greytown and the inhabitants of heaven. And what happens there is that the newcomers aren't able to fully enjoy and appreciate this place that they're in. For example, the grass, it's soft to the people who've come from heaven, but it has such a weightiness for the inhabitants of Greytown that they can't walk on it with their shoes off because it's so hard and so weighty. Or they see a beautiful waterfall which they should be able to stand under and let it cool them. But they can't stand under it because the weight of the water would crush them. It's so substantive, this place. And yet the people of Greytown can't fully enjoy it because they haven't embraced this new reality. I want to ask, I guess, can you imagine a place as substantive and beautiful as this city that we see depicted in Revelation 21 and 22? A place so resting, so full of joy, where the deep things of life, the things that mean something, are fully embraced, not glazed over in the pursuit of more stuff or more status or more experiences. And maybe this even allows us to reframe our perspective on thlipsis, on the suffering that we experience in this world. Because when two things are in tension, not only is there friction, but everybody around looks in for a moment to see why they're in tension with one another, don't they? There's a moment there where they clash, where there's an opportunity for our story to pop into the world, for people to ask, why is our story different? In the tensions that we experience daily, do we have the ability, I want to ask, to see differently? And then to live differently, and then to create things that show something different, and then help others to do the same, to taste and see that the Lord is good. Friends, as I come into land today, let me just reflect for one more moment with you on another magnificent metaphor that C.S. Lewis had for the imagination. Lewis saw imagination as distinct from reason. He wrote some amazing imaginative books like the Narnia series, The Great Divorce. He also wrote some amazing books that dug deeply into the truths of the Christian faith, imagination and reason. He believed wholeheartedly that both were important in communicating the Christian faith into the world. But for Lewis, imagination held a very special place. And he said, can we consider a lamp? You're in a dark room. Consider a lamp that's shining a sharp beam of light into a dark room. Reason, he said, is like looking at that beam of light from outside the beam of light. So you're standing in the dark room and you're looking at this beam of light, but you're outside it. You can talk about the beam of light. You can explain the beam of light. You can even tell other people about some of the particulars of that beam of light. But imagination is different. Imagination, he said, is like being invited to step inside the beam of light and to see what it casts its light onto. Consider with me that that beam of light might represent God's story of redemption in the world. Sometimes we fall into the trap of analysing the story of redemption from outside of it. And I guess my invitation to you today is to come and step inside the beam with me. It looks different in here. Remember back to where we started. We have this beautiful picture in Revelation where John is first told to look and he sees a door open to heaven, a door into the throne room standing open before him. And then this voice issues him this invitation, come inside. Let me show you something. I guess I want to issue that invitation this morning. Friends, if you've been standing outside of this story for too long, if you've never entered into this story, or if you're one that perhaps has become cynical or jaded by this story, I want to say, look, the door to the throne room is open. Let me be a voice that beckons you. Come inside. Come and see something. Let me introduce you or reintroduce you to the slain lamb, this one who is at the center of this story, who went to the cross for you and for me and for the entirety of the creation that he loves. That one is on the throne. You see, throne rooms are usually frightening places for people like you and for me to be. They're places where judgments are handed down, where extreme power is exercised. But because the slain lamb sits on this throne, it is a perfectly safe place for you and for me to be. We're even beckoned, in a sense, to see that one that sits on the throne as a father, a daddy that we can run to. It's a safe place for us to be. But for all of us, as I finish, I want to ask the question, what does it look like when you place yourself within that story? What do you see when you imagine yourself inside the beam? Well, surely in one direction, as we look down the stream of light, if it represents God's story of redemption in the world, then that means that surely we see the world to some extent as God sees it. If God's light of redemption is shining on the world, and we're inside the story, to some extent we see the world as God intends it and as God sees it. When we immerse ourselves, I believe, in this story, we are formed in such a way that we learn in an imperfect way to see reality as God sees it. We develop the capacity to imagine the world as God intends it to be and to become people who live that reality into the world. When we see right, friends, it helps us to live right. But here's the most important thing. When we stand within the light stream, if we turn around and we look back at the source of the light, what is it that we see? We see the author of that light stream. One thing that's really clear in Revelation is that the slain lamb is the center and the hero of this story that John is unpacking for us. We're invited once again to have our gaze drawn to the author of the story. So friends, can I ask you, where are you looking? Because where you are looking determines what you will see. For me, I get very easily distracted. I'm looking at parenting. I'm looking at housing. I'm looking at jobs. I'm looking at relationships. I'm looking at the problems I have to encounter every day. I'm distracted all the time. Parenting, housing, jobs, relationships, fear. Parenting, housing, jobs, relationships, fear. Look. Look. The slain lamb is on the throne. The new creation will be. Things are not as they seem. No matter what your reality is, what your world is screaming at you, this slain lamb has not left his post at the control room of the universe. And with those that are gathered around the throne in Revelation 4 and 5, and again here in Revelation 19, and again in Revelation 21 and 22, there can be no other appropriate response than to respond with praise because of what the slain lamb has done for us.